Good morning, everyone. Well, we are very honored. Judge Williams, Judge Tinder, and I are very honored to have these wonderful judges from Shanghai visiting us. And we will try very hard to behave ourselves. All right. So, case number one, 12-11-27, the United States versus Keskes. And good morning, Mr. Rolig.
May it please the court. My name is Tim Rolig. I represent the appellant, Ahmet Keskes. The trial error that we present in our brief goes to the most significant issue in the case, which was the government's proof regarding Mr. Keskes' knowledge. All of the issues reflect on that underlying issue, and the prejudice of those errors is reflected in the fact that without that evidence, the government's proof of his knowledge is lacking, such that these errors carry the significance, whether it's the harmless error for the first issue or the plain error in the remaining issues. The plain error in this case is the government's use of a term, but also the way that that was used. And it's the reference, continual reference, to gypsies as inveterate thieves, and those that deal with them, Mr. Keskes in particular, being in their company and therefore following those same
Mr. Rolig, I gather that the government itself raised this issue with the judge, and there was a discussion of how this should be handled at trial. What did Mr. Keskes argue at that time? Did the defense argue that the witnesses should not be referring to gypsies, for example? Because that does not seem to be the case.
And you're right, Your Honor. It's a somewhat of a red herring, though, this fact that the government raised this issue. Because when you look at it in context, they raise the issue and say, we're going to use this term gypsy, we want to make sure it's okay. Letting us know, or letting the court know in that instance, that it may be offensive to some to use that particular term. And really, the response by the defense was, you can use the term. The term itself was something that they essentially said was fine. Then we see how it's applied at trial, and it's not just the use of the term that is the objectionable aspects here. So I don't believe you can view that moment in the trial as something of an endorsement by Mr. Keskes or his trial lawyer about what will follow. That is, that the government will, mainly through Mr. Strugalewski and through Mr. Barnhill, will introduce this evidence and will later argue, the government will, that anyone who deals with gypsies, because they are inveterate thieves, are in fact dealing in stolen merchandise.
Well, I'm not sure that I see that kind of evidence that the government itself made any stereotypical or improper use of the witnesses' reference to gypsies while they argued Mr. Keskes' guilt to the jury. So maybe you can help me.
Sure, Judge. In the brief, we point to the places in their argument. The closing argument in particular is where that occurs, and it's the opening closing, so to speak, from the government's perspective, where that term is. And it's in specific reference to Mr. Keskes' recorded statement that is made, and the juxtaposition by the government is essentially the recorded statement by Mr. Keskes is enlightening of knowledge from their position, and this is what they're telling the jury, is enlightening of knowledge because he refuses to disavow his relationship or his knowledge of gypsies or his business dealings with gypsies. And the government essentially says that Keskes should have, at that point, denied having any dealings with them, denied having any knowledge, really, of them. And it was that lack of reaction that the government used to argue that his knowledge of the stolen merchandise comes from his dealing with these folks who they have portrayed throughout the trial as being stereotypical. I think that that's the clearest instance where the
but
government
that
utilized.
That seems to fit the evidence, though, where these people kept coming in and with things in bags and would leave them on the ground and so on and so forth. That it was a pattern of dealing with these individuals and refusing to inquire where these things came from. That seems to fit the argument.
It fits in the sense that there was certainly evidence through Mr. Strugalewski that he saw something along the lines that Your Honor just described.
Well, and wow. Police officer as well confirms that pattern of dealing.
And I think the significant thing is that they make no distinction during that testimony between any particular individuals who are doing this as they themselves being the thieves versus gypsies writ large. And they continually refer to it not as a particular activity of these specific individuals, but a characteristic of all gypsies. And it's a characteristic of all gypsies which makes the recorded statement significant. Their use of that evidence is essentially that the recorded statement by the defendant is an acknowledgement of dealing with these sort of inveterate thieves.
But Strugalewski told him on the tape to visualize how much stuff they can steal, to which Keskes responded, I don't care how they do it, what they do. And Strugalewski further told Keskes his main concern is paying out the gypsies. And Keskes responded he would write empty checks. So it's pretty clear that he knew that the goods were stolen, or there was a very strong suggestion, and it didn't really relate to this gypsies as bands of thieves when you look at the transcript.
On the recorded statement, I think that the error is because you can't interpret that any other way based on the way the government used the gypsy evidence. So Your Honor's correct that one inference potentially from that is some knowledge, or at least maybe more along the lines of putting the ostrich-type instruction. But, of course, with the gypsy evidence, that the way the government utilized it, then there's really no other way to interpret that, and I think that that's part of the error as well.
Do you want to go to your next argument?
Sure.
Thank you.
And it ties into this to some degree because, of course, the Roberts statement is a statement that was admitted as a background hearsay piece in the trial. And the government argues that we essentially waived that argument because
Did you object and say, no, Judge, it cannot come in for background either?
Trial counsel did not object, Judge. And we argue, obviously, that this is plain error. And it should be viewed as a forfeiture and not as a waiver, particularly because of the context of the trial. It had previously been admitted pretrial as a co-conspirator statement. My position is it would never be admissible as a co-conspirator statement, or it shouldn't have been. That would have been error. I think the government essentially concedes that on page 52 of their brief, where they say that this is a statement outside of the conspiracy. So faced with that pretrial ruling that it was coming in as a co-conspirator statement, I don't think that it's forfeiture. I'm sorry, I don't think that it's waiver for trial counsel to accept the government's concession there and let it in as background. It should have been objected to, but it wasn't. And the problem with the statement is it's the exact same activity as the entire trial put in through the CI, in this case Mr. Strugalewski. And it mirrors exactly what occurred with almost no limitation that you would normally see on background information. And the truthfulness of the underlying activity was critical to its use in any instance. And there could have been a much more truncated way to put that in without all that prejudicial
information. Yeah, but defense counsel agreed originally, originally as part of the Santiago proffer, it was really extensive. And then defense counsel and the government went over things, and that statement was actually shortened
when it was going to come in as background. So now you're saying it should have been shortened anymore, but defense counsel didn't ask for that.
It's true he didn't ask for that, and actually I think it's pretty clear that it wasn't really that shortened. Whatever they didn't take out, or whatever they took out, was not as that significant in comparison to what
right,
actually came in.
Right, but defense counsel didn't press for more to be taken out.
He did not, and I believe that the court should view that as a forfeiture in that situation because of how it occurred. It happened right in the middle of the government's case. It doesn't appear to be something that was thought out in advance. It appears to be offered sort of off the cuff by the government.
But that doesn't absolve defense counsel from responsibility. I mean, do you have any case law that says that when it happens off the cuff and unexpected that it's converted to a waiver and not forfeiture? Probably not.
Well, I think that is one of the factors of the court, and we do cite that case in the reply. I think that's one of the factors of the court to consider.
Mm-hmm. But this is something that had been talked about and discussed, so the whole issue was not something that was just sprung upon defense counsel.
That's certainly correct. And,
you want to save the rest?
I'll save the rest. Thank you.
All right, Mr. McFadden.
Excuse me. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Christopher McFadden on behalf of the United States. Let me pick up just where things left off, Judge. The arguments about the Robert testimony came in. All of that evidence came in by agreement. These arguments weren't just forfeited. They were affirmatively waived, and the Court shouldn't consider those arguments now. Let me just go through the chronology briefly. It's at pages 182 to 185 of the record.
The suggestion is that even if the conversations with Robert were formally admitted for background rather than for the truth, they really serve much more than a background or explanatory function. Does he have a point at all?
No, Judge. And here's why. First of all, it was agreed at the time that at the very minute that this testimony came in, there was going to be a limiting instruction given to the jury, telling the jury that it was only coming in order to explain why the CI did what he did next. So there was that limiting instruction right then and there. Then during the closing instructions, there was another limiting instruction. And then there was really no reference to the testimony by Robert at all, except a brief reference during the final closing argument when we said that the jury should believe that this meeting actually took place. But we never said to the jury that they should believe any of the hearsay in order to prove the matters that were asserted. Asking the jury to believe that the meeting took place is not a lot different from in a typical case where you have a 911 call. Officers say they went to a location because they received a 911 call. The juries often hear that the call was recorded. The fact that the call was recorded tends to suggest that that background call actually was made. And that was the only point that we ever made with this testimony. We never said rely on any of the statements by Robert for the truth. We just said you should believe that this meeting actually took place. The CI met with Robert, and then the CI reconnected with the defendant. And that was the only argument that was made with respect to that, Judge. Other than that, it wasn't even referenced. And in terms of the chronology, it had been admitted as a co-conspirator statement. We then said to the district judge that we had talked with defense counsel and that we agreed that we are now seeking to admit the statements just as background evidence in order to explain why the informant did what he did next. And we suggested that there be a limiting instruction so that it was clear right at the beginning what this was being offered for. And the district judge is then saying back to defense counsel, so what did you guys agree? And defense counsel is saying this would be satisfactory to me in light of the court's ruling. We've resolved issues between us. Give the limiting instruction.
That sounds like a reluctant agreement, though. Isn't the counsel really saying, in light of, and the fact, because it's coming in under Santiago, or would have anyway, this is better than that?
If that's the case, Judge, excuse me, then it's still an agreement that was made at the time. Defense counsel and everybody are saying it's better for it to come in under this set of facts where it's not going to be substantive evidence. It's better for it to come in as background evidence than the alternative. And we cited the court to United States versus Wesley, which I think is pretty close to being on point here, Judge. Obviously, every case has different facts, but in both of those situations, there was an issue that was presented In that case, it was whether a juror was biased or not. Everybody knew what the issue was. The court talked about it with the attorneys. No objections were made at the time. And then the trial proceeded the way that the judge said it was going to. In that case, he kept the juror on. And in this case, the evidence came in as background evidence, exactly as we had discussed it. So I do believe that that argument was waived. If it wasn't waived, it certainly there was not plain error by admitting that testimony. Let me turn then to the arguments related to the use of the term gypsies. And I think there are really two different arguments here. One is that it was plain error in violation of Rule 403 to even use the term. And I think the second is that we, in plain error, basically equated the fact that the defendant dealt with some of these vendors to guilt by association. And neither one of those arguments are borne out by the record. First of all, we did show sensitivity to the use of that term. We fronted it with the district judge. And we said we are open to the use of different terms. The reason that nobody saw a different way for the trial to proceed is because that term was so ingrained in the defendant's own vocabulary. He was using it on tape when he was talking to the informant. The informant was using it back when he was talking to the defendant. And then the employee, Gordon Barnhill, testified that he was also using that term when he was talking to the defendant at the warehouse. We never argued that all gypsies were thieves. We never said the defendant should be convicted because he dealt with gypsies. What we argued was that the defendant dealt with vendors who were gypsies and that these particular vendors were thieves. And that's entirely consistent with what we said we were going to do in the pretrial conference. We said that the witnesses were going to use the term gypsy and that we were then going to ask them, what do you mean by that? And that they were going to clarify that in their experience, the term gypsy means a group of people engaged in retail theft. And that's exactly how the evidence came in. And the defendant himself was operating from the premise that the gypsies who he was dealing with were thieves. He is repeatedly worried that they're being followed by the police. He is asking Gordon Barnhill to run criminal history checks on these vendors and find out if they have outstanding arrest warrants. And then, of course, there's the defendant's own statements on the tape where the informant is saying, I'm dealing with gypsies. Can you imagine how much these people can steal? And the defendant's response is, I don't want to look at it that way. I don't care how they get it or what they do. And then the informant says, so you don't check if it's stolen or not. As long as you get an invoice, you pay. And his response is, yeah. And then he picks up the ball and he really runs with it. He says, I would prefer to pay these gypsies in cash, but I'll write them checks in the name of cartoon characters. When you give me an invoice, just make up the name of some company, like Blah Blah Trading Company. When I give you an invoice, we'll just cut the header off so that nobody knows where it came from. And again, I would like to just stress, it was never argued that the defendant should be convicted because he dealt with gypsies. It was because the evidence showed that he knowingly dealt with vendors who were gypsies and they were thieves. And the gypsy evidence was just a small part of that, Your Honors. There was the fact that he ignored complaints from customers that he was selling stolen computers. There was evidence that he was selling products, golf clubs especially, for between $40 and $150 at a time when those same things were brand new, popular items selling in the stores for between $300 and $500. And all of the products that he sold had indicia of theft. They still had the price stickers on them that were applied at the stores. They still had the active security tags on them, suggesting that they were never turned off. They were in the original packaging, new and unopened. When he sold golf clubs, they were always missing the head covers on the clubs because it's easy to steal a golf club from the front of the store, but the head covers are always in the back of the store. And he always had the clubs, but no head covers, suggesting again that the clubs were stolen. And then there was the fact that he had no alternative sources of supply, and the story that he gave didn't check out. He said that he was buying from resellers or from closeout companies or liquidators. But when we look through more than $12 million worth of expenses from his company, he never wrote a single check to any liquidator or any closeout company. On top of that, the retailers came in and said that the things that he was selling were not things that were ever sold at closeout. And then there was other evidence about the way that he received the products as well, Your Honors. I would just remind the court, all of the arguments here today are subject to the plain error standard of review, except for the argument regarding the opening statement, and we dealt with the opening statement argument in our briefs. Unless you have any questions for me, I'll just submit on the briefs.
I do have questions about the sentencing issues. Is there anything in the record at sentencing that shows that the defendant sold skincare products that were not properly stored?
No, Judge. And we never argued that he created a health risk by selling products that were improperly stored. What the district judge did, you're probably getting to the judge's reference
right.
to the victim impact statement.
Right.
And I would just point out it's the defendant's burden because there was no argument at trial to show there's a high degree of certainty that the judge relied on an erroneous fact and then also that there was a high degree of prejudice. And I don't – even that first argument, is there a high degree of certainty that the judge relied on an erroneous fact? I don't – we can't say that here, Judge. Here's why. The district judge accurately quoted from the victim impact statement. And the district court never actually said that the defendant actually did create a health risk. He said that he could have created a health risk if the products had been stored improperly. And there's a big distinction between the two.
And is that enough for an enhancement on that? Wasn't there a two-level enhancement because of this?
There was not, Judge. There was no enhancement as a result of this. This was just one of the things that the court mentioned as it was discussing the 3553 factors.
I see.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
For all these reasons, we ask that the conviction and the sentence be affirmed in this case.
Thank you, Mr. McFadden. Thank you. Mr. Rowling.
Thank you, Judge. Unless there are any further questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And